Welcome to The Roth Effect. I am Carol Roth, and today I'm talking with Adam Townsend, who describes himself as an investor, extreme salesman, and futurist. And this is a wild one. This is a podcast unlike any discussion I believe I've had before. We talk with Adam about his mega success on Wall Street to his own sort of personal depression, feeling like he didn't have a purpose. And then now his extreme optimism on the future and things like Space Force, being bullish on America, being bullish on Wall Street. And probably my favorite part is his philosophy on what we are witnessing vis-a-vis the what he calls the greatest roll-up of power in all of history. From the political class to the mega tech corporations, something that's sort of depressing as a free marketeer, but definitely incredibly interesting. This one will make you think. So here we go. Enjoy the show. So, Adam, you've got a pretty unique background. Your bio includes being an investor and an extreme salesman.
Yeah, true.
For people who aren't familiar with you, give us a few highlights. What does that mean?
Okay, it's a fair question. Sometimes I get asked it. Sometimes people just kind of assume it. I'm a bit of a futurist, right? And, I'm an investor and I've done very well. And but there's a story before I was an investor, because I've been on kind of both sides of the marketplace, you know, as a, you know, the worker bee, then a person who's in charge of the worker bee, and then, you know, hiring all the worker bees, and then our companies went public. And, in 2012, I decided to retire kind of for the last time, and I was young. So I'm a futurist, right? Even when I was a little kid, I had a really clear path of what I wanted to do. I knew I wanted to work on Wall Street. I knew I wanted to stay in New York. I knew I was going to be very successful. But I didn't want to go to school because, you know, school is not really, I'm not a big fan of college. I'm just not, you know, because I knew even as a young kid that I wanted to retire young. And I knew as a young kid, really young kid, that by the time people finish college and an advanced degree, I'll have the job that they dreamed of, and I'm going to win. I'm always going to win.
I've got to interrupt you right there, because, you know, when I was a kid, outside of eating paste, I didn't know anything. I never really know much of anything about Wall Street. Yeah. How did you know so early that Wall Street was the path for you? Because I didn't even know about it until I got to college.
Yeah. So there were a lot of different directions I knew about. And, I can't tell you I was kind of financially literate at such a young age, but I knew where the money was. And I wanted to go. My theory since I was a little kid was that I wanted to go where the money was, because, you know, you can peel off enough for yourself to make a living. So, that's what I wanted to do. So there were a few different options I had. I knew I was going to go to sales because I knew I didn't want to go to school. And there really weren't, I wanted to be a doctor and I was thinking about being a lawyer. I wanted to be an astronaut. There were just a lot of things I wanted to do, but a lot of them required me to stay in school. So I heard about Wall Street, I think, at a young age, and I didn't have any family from Wall Street. And I just got really interested. I got really interested in when, I grew up in a city on 4th Street and Avenue A, and my sister and I would always walk around the city. And I think I was really became interested in when I walked on Wall Street. And back then, you know, now it kind of sucks, but back now it's just tourists, you know, but back then, you could feel the electricity. Like right now, if you go there, you're just going to feel kind of the batteries of smartphones. But back then, you really felt it. You felt stress, you know, and it was a wonderful place. And, you know, I'd go there when I was 10, 11, 12. I would cut school a lot. My sister would cut school. We loved growing up in a city. And, I just kind of knew what I wanted to do. And then I remember speaking with people. So I also used to cut school and go to the United Nations, right? And
but where are your parents in all of this?
Yeah, well, you know, my parents were, I've had this conversation with a lot of people because I was like a nuclear explosion, right? So the thing with a nuclear explosion is it can be a really good thing if it's harnessed and you give it a canal to travel along. But my parents couldn't really do that, right? So I kind of had to figure out everything for myself. And school was fun because I like playing with other kids. But I always felt like I wanted to get out and just start working. I really did. It's kind of hard to explain to people, but I knew. I think Scott Adams and I, talked about this just in some DMs, and he wrote something. I forget exactly the way he worded it. But I felt like my future was already kind of written out for me, and I was just trying to fulfill what we already had been written out. So I was trying to catch up to page 10 while I was still on page one of my life. And so
how did you do this? So you have this desire. You know that you want to be on Wall Street. You don't like school. You don't want to go there. How do you convince somebody on Wall Street to take a chance on you?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. So I knew I had to kill time, right? Because by the time I was 15 and 16, I already kind of had a feel for it. And 18, it was a short thing, but I had to kill time. And in killing time, I traveled a lot around the world, hitchhiked a lot, had a lot of fun. And then, when I came back, I took, I guess, a retail job working at some store and then another retail job. And then, finally, I felt it was time. I felt like, I was up to page 10. And Wall Street was a much different place than it is now. So back then, I cold called into, I'm going to make up a number and it's not going to be accurate, but it gives you a sense of the size. I'm going to say 30 firms, 25 firms, 30 firms. And back then they used to advertise in New York Times, right? Wound up calling into a lot of firms, and most of them, I would say of those, I probably booked around 8 meetings because there was kind of an urgency for people to hire back then because, Wall Street was growing so quickly. They needed to capture some labor and some alpha, smart people. So I went to a lot of different firms, and I wound up at Gruntel & Company. So I wound up at one of the people I had interviewed with was a former person from Goldman Sachs who had just left to start his own firm, and he was an analyst. He was one of the all-star analysts. So I think he went to like Soundview back then or something. Soundview was just building up.
Sure.
No, he went to Alex Brown, I forget. Whatever, it doesn't make a difference. I had a choice of two firms. I had a choice of Gruntel & Company, and I had a choice of Goldman Sachs. And so my two choices back then were I was going to work for an analyst. And I knew my parents didn't understand me. So I knew I needed to find kind of like and I knew I could be really abrasive. I know who I was at that point, although I didn't particularly like that. And so I knew I needed somebody to kind of like, fulfill the, to cover my ass a little bit, I guess, because, I knew I was in a nuclear explosion. But I also knew that I need some harnessing into the right canal. So I wound up at having a choice between Gruntel and Goldman Sachs. And Goldman Sachs had Rick Sherlund. And Rick Sherlund was, this is 1990, 1989, I guess, 1987. No, what am I saying? It was 1987, 1988. So back then, Rick Sherlund was discovering companies like Microsoft, Novell, Lotus Suites. There was a lot happening in a sector that back then was called productivity tools, right? And Windows, the first generation of Windows had just come out. They had beaten all the competitors in terms of a shell that sits on top of a DOS. And see, I'm an old guy now, Carol. And
I'm not that far behind you, so don't bring that up.
Yeah. So I had a choice of going that way, and I really liked Rick, or going the other way, which was Gruntel & Company. And I knew one of the top people there, and I don't want to discuss too many people's names because I don't think it's fair. But I interviewed with one of the top people there. Guy loved me. I loved him. I thought it was awesome. And I wound up working with him, and it just worked out really well. And then one day, he left the firm, and I wound up with big positions in a whole bunch of different companies, including Micron. The semiconductor company. So this is like around 92 now or something. And those stocks were doing well, but they were trading very volatile, right? Because Japan was going through their own type of issues. And, so then I got involved in short squeezing and doing a whole bunch of things. And I was very involved with what's called the Ray Dirk Short Busters Club. you might be too young though, because now I'm going to test you. And that did really well. We did Conseco. And then I left. I started my own firm. I sold my firm. I started a research shop, sold my research shop. And I didn't want to go back to Wall Street. You know, I felt I had done it. Didn't want to do it again. I'm not a person who likes pattern recognition. As soon as I see a pattern, I want to get away from it. So
let me stop you there for a second, because there's a lot to unpack there. Given your position, do you consider yourself more of a trader or more of an investor?
Definitely an investor. I've never seen, and I just had this conversation with somebody earlier today, I've never seen a trader. You know, I'm old enough now to have seen people through their life cycles of business and careers, right? And I've never seen a trader walk away from a table richer than where they started. They wind up a lot more aggravated, and maybe with a different spouse or two, or a different significant other or two. But for what it's worth, my game plan, even as a kid, was I knew I was going to make a lot of money even pushing a hot dog cart, right? Back then, they didn't have the Dove bars, and they didn't have the other hot things that, you know, the varieties that became on the street. So I knew I was going to do well. So the thing is, if you're trading, and, you know, it's been a big bull market, so hopefully everyone's trading it. But if you're trading, you know, most of the time, you know, when you count back, you know, after 5 or 6 years or 10 years, and you look back at the actual yield you got, versus the quality of life and how much you had to give up, right? Because you got to give up a lot to be successful. It's not a good yield. I mean, maybe what do you make? $300,000 a year, $400,000 a year. That's it. You lost your life for that. So no, and that's if they're a good trader, because most of these people are emotional wrecks, and they're always trying to make up for the last loss. So no, I've never really been a trader. I tried it. I lost my shirt for a few months, or not even for a few months, for 2 weeks. And I didn't like it. I'm not. I'm an investor. You know, I've held Tesla for 8 years now. Mm. You know, I never thought about selling it even for a single day. I've had Facebook since I met Mark when they were doing the roadshow, the dog and pony show, to soak up some aftermarket stock right before they went public. Never. I don't think, you know, I haven't sold a lot of stocks. I've had to sell on instances where, you know, it was a regular scheduled selling, or I have a family office where I was just kind of, reallocating from here to there. But I still have Trinet, still have Slack, still have Insperity, you know.
So do you think that trading mentality, that emotional, you know, got to time the market, got to be in and out at the right time, is where most investors go wrong? Or is there something else that you've taken away in your experience?
Yeah, so it's interesting, because I try and think of my own philosophy, and I'll talk about extreme sales because you included that, but I'm not going to talk about it right now. So I try, you know, over the years, I've tried to understand myself a little bit better, and kind of, you know, I did so much intuitively, and I was so lucky, and I learned from some of the best. But, you know, I was also at a point where I wanted to look back and figure out how I did well and why I did well. And, you know, sometimes, you know, and I'll tell you later, but, you know, 2012, you know, success does catch up with you. And sometimes, you know, you find out you're really depressed, even though you've done so well. So I started kind of reverse engineering myself. And, my experience is people have a lot of emotional anxiety. There's an emotional reservoir that people have. And I didn't realize at the time how cheaply I was giving it away and how I wasn't getting any yield on it. So, you know, you have an emotional reservoir, and I don't think you should use it on trading, because you're actually, you know, they're very easy, I guess, maybe I would say they're very easy to deplete or to exhaust that emotional reservoir, and it's extremely difficult to replenish.
Hmm. Oh, that's very wise counsel, very wise counsel. So when you sort of dissect yourself and you bring up, you know, sort of this, you know, flirtation with depression, but also, you know, kind of knowing what you've wanted to do and you don't like pattern recognition, what do you think it is that drives you?
Yeah. So, you know, now it's different. So back then, I didn't really want to be rich. I mean, I knew I was going to be rich, but I didn't really, and I don't want to be involved in a delusion, but I should include that just because I did know, right? I knew I was going to do well. I knew I was going to outwork. I knew I was smarter than most people. I knew my cognitive intelligence was very high. I can't really say, I really just felt like I was, again, just like Scott Adams had said, he really did say it. And I DM'd him and we talked about it. And, I just felt like the bulk of my life had been written. I was just trying to fulfill it. And then I'll tell you, so now I'll go into the depression part because I've had this conversation with a few people because we all have to learn from each other's experiences, right? And, the thing on Wall Street, and this is something why people shouldn't trade, to be honest with you, it's another reason. But the thing on Wall Street is, you live your life in anticipation of the next earnings announcement or the next big news or this person crossing this stock with that stock. And, whatever it is, there's always something that you're looking forward to or you're looking with anticipation towards and with anxiety what's going to happen next week or next month, right? That's how you live. There's no other way to get around it. You're kind of in, there's no sense of now, right? There's no sense of the present. You're always living in the future and the current is miserable because you're waiting with bated breath for what's going to happen next. So in 2012 and 2013, a lot of my companies went public, right? And I had already kind of semi-retired for like the second time at that point. And a lot of my companies went public all at once. And then I realized, now I'm up to the part of the book where I don't know what's going to happen, right? And I realized I was massively depressed. So back then, I weighed like 215 pounds, I think.
Right? Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so, I had always gone kind of like on a cycle of being in good shape, really good shape, and in horrible shape, right? And so now, because all my compensation was kind of on the back end with a lot of these things, I'd spent the last 5 years, 6 years, 7 years building up a lot of things. They all worked out. And then finally I realized I didn't really need to work. I didn't want to work. I just wanted to travel. My dad had just passed on and I knew I wanted to travel and I just never made time for it. So, it's a weird thing when you realize you hate yourself, right? Because when you're very successful, you can't be successful without running faster than the next guy, right? So the next guy is going to be the one eaten by the bear, right? And so I just always ran faster, always ran smarter. I always used a lot of my charm. I was always very thoughtful to people, but I always drove with a lot of urgency. And so in 2012, I realized, 2013 actually, I realized I was miserable, right? I had done well. I had fulfilled everything I had planned on doing up to that point. I didn't know I was going to retire, at that point, but, I realized I was miserable. I was fat. I didn't realize how fat I was until I spoke with somebody and I was like, maybe I should get my jaw done or something. And they were like, no, you've got double chin because you're fat. Right. So, I decided to get in really good shape. And, but at the same time, you really learn at a certain point in your life, I guess when you're in middle age, if you're stupid and if you're really smart, you learn it when you're much younger, but money, you can't buy your way out of depression and you can't buy your way out of being in bad shape. It's not going to happen. I needed to actually work on something I never worked on before. I needed to work on myself, right? I was always working on a stock or working on a company or building up this, building up that. And I was always running. So now all of a sudden I couldn't run anymore. So, these things caught up with me. So I decided to get in really good shape. And, I'll say, I'm happy to have the camera on because I'm Diesel. I'm in really good shape. It's true.
It's awesome. What do you do for your workout? Do you have a favorite workout?
No, it's really not about working out. It's about diet. Honestly, it's about diet. I mean, it depends because I'm 54. So for me, in order for me to have muscle quality, it means I've got to work out with weights more than the next person would. Because my muscles won't have that density just because I'm older. But, for the most part, it's really just a rigid diet, no salt, no sugar. So tonight, I'm actually going to have a slice of pizza with my wife. We're really looking forward to it. It's a beautiful day. We're going to play some Scrabble. But so the diet is really rigid. I just got in Diesel shape. I went all the way down to 156. I decided it was too thin. I went up to like 165, which is where I am now. Give or take, I don't even know. I'm definitely not over 165. And my body fat went down, ridiculous. I mean, I'll share with anybody the pictures. I mean, it's just ridiculous. I think the last time I looked at it at that point was like 7% or something. And but you know, so now you're just looking at the surface of something, which is totally cool. But remember something, a person, you know, that's there's an aesthetic, right? And the problem is when you're really good at sales and you're really good at Wall Street is you still can kind of deceive yourself, right? But I couldn't deceive myself any longer. So I still needed to work on my own emotional health. And the thing that happens, you know, when you're working for somebody else, right? No matter what it is, whether you're working for the shareholders, whatever it is, because I've done all of that, right? I've worked for the immediately where my bosses were the board of directors, or, you know, when we did China, whatever it is. And so, or when we did Workday, for example, or whatever it is, Insperity, back then it was called Administaff. But the thing is, all your time is not your own, right? You may think it's your own time, but you've got to do, you know, what, and whether you do something in this 15 minutes or whether you do something 6 hours later and you do it then, you know that you have a certain amount of time that, you know, you've got to, your time is theirs, right? They're leasing your life, right? So everything is slotted out for you. Everything in your life is kind of carved out for you. Your time allocation, you have no sense of the value of time. You have no sense of the yield of time because you sold it, right? You've been leasing it to somebody else. And then the weird thing is you know, when you realize that you've lost any sense of the equity of time, any sense of how to regain your own time. And so I started trying to figure that out because I realized really quickly, you know, you still wake up at 6:30 in the morning, you still go to sleep at 10 o'clock at night, whatever it is. But that's still not your time, right? Because then you wake up in the morning and, you know, there's only so many errands you can do, right? So I needed this to recapture my time, and that became an effort in itself. So now my body is already getting in really good shape, but now I really needed to work on my mind. And I started getting into philosophy. I started reading Seneca on the shortness of life and things that were the advice my parents never gave me, right? Because they were always middle class. And I thought their existence kind of sucked in that way. So, you know, I hated that. So they couldn't tell me what to do. So they didn't have the advice to give me. So I thought Seneca on the shortness of life and Letters to Lucilius, right, was like a parent speaking to me from 2,000 years ago. And I love language, right? I love the nuances of language. I abhor, I'll just call it bad language, right? Which is something that's happening now where there's a high pain tolerance with just language. So I loved...
Or in 2020, it's sort of like the doublespeak of 1984, where everyone has just taken whatever meaning we've ascribed to words and thrown that out the window.
Yeah, and a lot of that has to do with, because we're moving to a gig economy, these people have a lot of job insecurity. And what they're now learning at Facebook, and I bought Facebook stock because I knew all those kids were going to get fired. They're idiots. And I knew they were petitioning for their own unemployment, and they didn't know that. But one of my hobbies, and I know you were going to ask me about it before, later, is I listen to a lot of earnings calls as a hobby. Isn't that crazy? I love it.
I mean, not if you enjoy it. There is no crazy hobby for something you enjoy. And we have so much more to talk about, but I do want to take a quick minute to talk about our sponsor. The Roth Effect is brought to you in part by FutureFile. What do you think is the biggest issue when a loved one ages or passes away? Is it dealing with end-of-life tasks, knowing their social media wishes, finding their accounts and passwords, getting family members to agree on important issues? Well, whether it's wishes, information, burden, time, or money, FutureFile has you covered for all of that and more in our easy-to-use kit. From finding important documents like wills and powers of attorney to emergency contact information and social media wishes, copies of keys, financial account information, medical information, and so much more, FutureFile has it all for one low cost. We're talking under $100. So whether you're a parent, a spouse, an adult child, or even a single individual, FutureFile is a must-have for you and your loved ones. And I fully guarantee you will love it and find it valuable because I created it. Visit FutureFile.com today. That's FutureFile.com. So Adam, you're talking about this concept of, you know, not being able to measure time. And it's one of the interesting things for me when people talk about income inequality, because, you can measure dollars, right? You know, that those are commodities, they're the same, everybody has a certain amount of them and you can measure them, but you can't compare these other inputs like time, like relationships, all of these other things that are not commoditized that are on the flip side of a lot of those inequality discussions. Yeah, that's something that you've ever thought about?
Look, I've traveled all over the world. I live part-time overseas, and I can tell you, people who talk about income inequality in the U.S. should just stop talking about income inequality in the U.S. because they have no idea what they're talking about. America has never had, and certainly doesn't have now, real income inequality. What they have is people who can't afford iPhone, whatever the model they're up to right now. And, you know, look, I gave up my life to do well, right? So what about happiness inequality? Because I was freaking miserable, right? I was freaking miserable. So what about happiness inequality? If I jumped off a building because I was really depressed, right? Mm. It's really weird when you realize that you spent your last 30 years doing something and then you stop and your kind of emotional being catches up to how, you know, to you. And you're like, I hate me. And then you remember all that stupid stuff you said, and then you've got to forgive yourself. So what is the equality if I had jumped off a building? And remember, I come from Wall Street. I'm happy to talk about it because this is not unusual on Wall Street. You know that. And entrepreneurs, people who start up companies know all about this, right? This is how you live your life. And then what about happiness and equality, right? Because my life would have been over. Theirs is still going on. Maybe I lived my life with a little bit more luxury, but they're going to have the opportunity to live it with a lot more peace and happiness and family and love, right?
So, yeah, there's a saying that that I have sort of taken ownership of, even though I didn't come up with it, that money cannot buy happiness, even though it's more comfortable to cry in a Mercedes than in a bicycle. So it's, you know, there's this perception that just because you have all of this money that all of a sudden you become happier, that it becomes easier for you. And I think that is a common misconception. And certainly it may provide you a different level of comfort in your misery, but it doesn't solve that internal struggle. And sometimes it actually exacerbates it.
Yeah. So I don't really believe in income inequality. I think that's just a political device. I think it's for idiots. I don't like hearing it. There's a lot of phrases I don't like hearing. I don't like hearing what they call cultural appropriation, right? Because I've lived overseas and, you know, I speak different languages and, you know, if I'm in India, I'll speak Hindi. You know, it's not them talking about it, but, you know, I don't want to get too lost on that, but I don't like that phrase, cultural, whatever it's called, cultural appropriation. I don't even
understand what it is. I mean, I guess if you did something and said, I created it, maybe that's appropriation, but it seems to me most of the time it's appreciation, not appropriation.
But, you know, look, I could talk about this forever, but, you know, I don't want to, but there's, it's just, it's an idiot political device.
And life's too short, so we should not talk about things that you don't want to talk about because we have so many other things to talk about.
Well, because it's not a satisfying talk, because we could talk about it for 10 hours and then we go outside in the world and it's still kind of a picket sign that's held up, right? So but you mentioned income inequality, and, you know, I'm a huge bull on the stock market, and I didn't see any reason in March why America couldn't just give everybody 100 shares of Amazon stock, give everybody 100 shares of the FANG stocks, and you solved income inequality. I mean, you actually did solve income inequality.
I mean, I've suggested that everybody take their Social Security away from the government and instead have it invested, and then we're all invested in capitalism. You earn a better return, and it's less money for the government to take out and respend. It seems to me that would be an easy way to get people all aligned and invested.
If, you know, provided there's some kind of a fiduciary obligation that somebody's got to hold on to, right? But so, you know, I'm a huge bull on America. I came into the market in 87. I came in.
Wait. Just to put this historically, when exactly in 87?
I came in 3 months before the crash.
Wow.
Yeah. And I worked for the analyst out of his own shop. And then his shop was part of Gruntel. But back then, there weren't the Chinese walls, right, that you have now. You know,
anybody who doesn't know what happened, October 19th, 1987 was Black Monday. And that's at the time when the Dow lost what was it, like 500 points, which at the time was like 22% of its value. Now, you know, that's like that's an average day in the stock market when it goes down. But it was a really big deal. And it was the first time that the Fed came in and sort of supported the market in an unusual way, which we can talk about in a bit.
Yeah. So, but I knew, see, again, I was smarter than everybody else because I waved goodbye to all those people. I'm like, okay. They were like, you know, I can't take this business anymore. I'm burned out, blah, blah, blah. And I'd be like, I'd be waving goodbye to them because I was going to get their books. And I knew the market was going to recover because, see, I grew up in a time, and I guess so did you, where, you know, we watched Star Trek, right? Everything about my life was optimism. So I was like, listen, man, America's going to be in space, right? We're gonna be in the Federation or whatever the good guys were in space. And, you know, when I was growing up, kind of the big thing was I want to be the person to cure cancer, whatever it is. So I was totally bullish on the market. And I would just wave goodbye to these losers and I would get their books and I'd call up their clients and my business grew like that. And, you know, it was great. So you got me distracted, right? What was I talking about?
Talking about 1987, you've been a bull on the market. You're an optimist,
which
it pays to be an optimist.
No, we were talking about giving everybody stock. So I don't see any. I mean, in March, I was screaming buy stocks, just screaming. It was obvious that you know, that they were laying out some news to trap some shorts, that they were shaking the trees. They were taking out a lot of retail investors. Very obvious that what was happening. You know, there was no reason not to buy stocks. You know, these hedge fund managers were like, the world's going to end. When are they ever going to tell the truth? Their job is to lie. I've done this all my life. So you know, I think I even tweeted. I use Twitter as like a historical archive, right? I timestamp everything.
It's a journal, right?
The way I use it, you've seen the way I use it. I'm good at it. Yeah. And so I timestamp. It was like March 14th. I went in with Boeing, with Facebook, with just a whole bunch of stocks. Actually, that was my big day, actually. And then we made an announcement a few days later. But so why couldn't we just have given everybody 100 shares of the FANG stocks, right? You know Netflix, you know Facebook has taken over the world, you know Tesla's taken over the world, you know Boeing's taken over the world. So why not just give everybody 100 shares of Amazon this and then call it a day, right? We would have solved income inequality within 6 months. They'd be rich. Now that they shouldn't be allowed to sell it then, but they can collateralize it, right? So, but then, you know, the people would have said, well, then you're going to give rich people 100 shares too. And I'm like, so what? Somebody gives me 100 shares of stock with Facebook. So what? Who cares? Right? Because you're also going to be giving it to a lot of poor people. And then another political device would have been these little angry baristas would have said, well, you're just trying to do it because then, you know, you own 10,000 shares of Facebook and then you're just trying to do it to prop up your own stock. And, you know, that's something I hear a lot from like the angry barista types and,
the angry barista.
Tell
me more about the angry barista class. I want to hear about them.
Yeah. I mean, there's just a bunch of people that are just, I also call them latte slurpers, right? I don't know if you've ever seen that thing I post on Twitter. It's hysterical, but there's just a whole bunch of people that have, and they're usually white liberals. And I hold some responsibility for my people, right? And but the thing is that they're squandering their inheritance because they never really had to work. Their idea of work was like when I came into Wall Street in 1987, I waved goodbye to everybody. That's the way I think of these people. I don't care who takes me. I'm a big believer in Space Force, right? Very big advocate for it. And I don't care who takes me into space. As long as they're wearing the American flag, I don't care. And if these kids don't feel that they can be competitive and they just want to negotiate for a raise in their UBI, their universal basic income, you know, that's...
So let's talk about this because this is fascinating. So you're an optimist. You've been optimistic in America. You know, we're Gen X. We're the optimist generation. Now we have a generation that's angry and sad and unwilling to do what it takes. Are you still optimistic in America?
Because I don't think they're going to endure. I know a lot more immigrants, honestly, than I know. You know, I've got businesses in India and I travel and I own properties in Manhattan. I own properties in Long Island City. Nancy and I have recently decided to commit all of our time to Long Island City. And, you know, I know a lot more immigrants than I know, you know, people born here.
Yeah.
And I speak to them about all this type of stuff. And, look,
and they laugh, right? It's like they laugh at the people who are born here.
Well, these people are capitalists. So they're looking at this class of people the same way I looked at waving goodbye to the Wall Street brokers who couldn't survive the emotional devastation of, you know, 1987. So they're just waving goodbye. They're not the ones that are out there protesting because they're beginning to do really good. I mean, I was just talking to a friend of mine who's Bengali who came here. His parents actually came here first and then he came here. And, you know, he just bought his first building, right? And, you know, the wealth story in America is all about buying real estate. You keep your mouth shut, you rent it out, boom. You know, you leverage a little bit for this, you leverage it. So they're looking at these kids the same way I looked at my elders on Wall Street in 1987. Mm-hmm. They're just waving goodbye. And it's not them that are doing all the protesting. It's people who appoint themselves their surrogate, right? And, you know, I was telling people because I listen to a lot of earnings calls and, you know, I normally let my managers do this, but I love Mark Zuckerberg. Met him twice. Huge fan. Just a huge fan. The guy is absolutely brilliant. And met him before the IPO. And I knew he was going to do good. And I listened to a lot of the earnings calls there. And I listened to a lot of, well, I could go down a list, but it doesn't make a difference. But they were pretty explicit that they were going to transform their workforce into contractors. And, you know, I'm the investor in me says, you know, you buy the stock because we're going to get some upward surprises, right? You know, that's pretty obvious that they were guiding Wall Street expectations lower. But then they, you know, when you're a public company, you can sandbag, right? And, you know, you've got a lot of places where you can, where you had deliberately put a lot of fat. Because if you need to make earnings, you can cut that fat, right? So that's what they were doing. And I knew it. Last year, they were making this announcement. In 2019, they were making this. In July, I remember listening to it. So,
by the way, I never give stock picks, but I do remember when Facebook fell off a cliff sometime, I guess it was end of last year. It was in like in the 160s. And that was one of the only times I went out and I said, buy Facebook right now.
Yeah, you couldn't go wrong. So the thing is that, you know, these kids are, you know, they're talking about immigration. Their idea of immigration is they can tip less at a bar, right? That's really what they think of immigration. And it sounds a horrible thing, but we all need to be honest that their argument for immigration is not that it's competition, but that it's going to make their restaurant bill cheaper. And so, but I know these people. Right. I mean, I live to them. I rent to them. We talk all the time. I work out. Everybody in my neighborhood knows me. They knew me there. They definitely know me here. And I can tell you that we speak all the time about these things and not really on a political side, because a lot of this really isn't political. A lot of it is, you know, it's the view, whether it's Trump or Biden. Right. People, you know, these people love capitalism and they're smarter and they're hungrier. And I know what it's like to be smarter and hungrier. I truly do. I know what it's like.
And so do you think, you know, given the trajectory, because, you know, one of the things, and I am the most pro-capitalist person anybody knows, but obviously, you know, we've imported a lot of democratic socialism. I mean, we spend, you know, around $60,000 per household at all the different government levels currently, and they're trying to do more. Yeah. Do you think that, you know, capitalistic spirit endures, and, you know, that our political class and all of these people who don't know a lick about economics and a lick about history and a lick about what they're talking about, that keep pushing us away from capitalism. Do you think America retains enough of that, you know, for the next 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years, that we continue to attract all of these immigrants who embody this capitalistic spirit and who want to come here and take advantage of the American dream? Can we manage that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, America's not going to substantially change in that way, because these people are not, you know, they're not well read. They're not that smart. And so I've been calling this for the last few years. So, you know, for me, this is just part of my future. Is, you know, years ago, I was writing about when megacorps become countries, which is where we are now. So, you know, the bad part of the transformation is that they're taking themselves out of the job market, because, you know, companies, and look, I've been there, I'm an executive, right? And companies don't want woke. At the end of the day, Because look at Spotify. They've got people complaining about, you know, Joe Rogan. Spotify is going to fire all those people. They're going to put them as 1099s because they want to take the headline risk off, right? Don't you think so?
I mean, I don't know enough about Spotify's business model, and I certainly think that there's a lot of stepping around issues and some companies potentially going in the wrong direction. But at the end of the day, companies are part of the Green Party. They just want to make money. They don't care about red or blue or woke or whatever. They're just focused on their business singularly. And so, yeah, anything that's a distraction to that over periods of time, I think goes away with the tide.
So when you're, you know, when you're an executive, right? And when I, let me specify, when you have some obligation to the performance of the company and shareholder return, right? You're very cognizant of risks, right? Because your CEO always explains that to you, or the board of directors. And sometimes, you know, I don't know how it is these days. It's a little bit different actually these days because, you know, the venture capital is very risk averse and they don't like holding an inventory of risk, but most of their companies are unprofitable. But so the thing is, when you're actually in a real profitable company and you've got a good board of directors, one of the things that they do is they teach you how to manage risk, which is something that I, you know, was fortunate enough to learn. And, you know, just kind of in, you know, reducing risk, understanding the risk and understanding, you know, what your risk appetite is. And, you know, headline risk from these people about Joe Rogan is the same. You know, Spotify is letting them do this. They don't really care because they're going to fire those people. They're going to transform them to 1099. And look at what happened with Starbucks. Starbucks went and said, I don't know if you remember this, but they, you know, had some type of a social justice movement in one of the places. And I don't know. I don't pay too much attention to, you know, these type of things because I don't know these type of things that well. So I'm assuming it had some type of merit. Nevertheless, then they rolled out like this color brave, right? They spent a few million dollars doing a color brave, and then you know, they got the good headlines from that. And at the same time, they also announced that they were going to lay off do a big reduction in force. So I've been through all this before. I know the games because I've also played the games, right? So these kids are making themselves unhireable. So what do I think happens? I think we're looking at a caste system almost in America. And that caste system is either Amazon will hire you as a W-2 or you're a pleb. That's it. And plebs aren't going to make any money. And so now what you're seeing is you're seeing a real displacement of even the Washington elite, where Amazon, Google, Facebook, and, you know, the big tech companies and big defense companies are taking the DC. They're taking the entire political apparatus and unwinding it and installing themselves as the new nobles, right? So you had Antifa shouting down, you know, in Georgetown against the politicians. They're displacing them. You're seeing the old nobles get taken out by the new nobles. And so what's going to happen? I think Amazon today announced that they were going to open up their own university. It goes obvious. These little twerps
It makes a lot of sense, and our shared friend Jake Novak's actually been talking about that for quite some time. All right, Adam, this is so fascinating. So you're talking about these companies sort of replacing the politicians, but at the end of the day, aren't the politicians the ones who are sort of doing their bidding? I mean, the reality is every time they ask for more regulation, all they're doing is trying to create, you know, more competition and more road or anti-competition and more roadblocks for new startups to come into the space.
Well, I didn't phrase it like that. Okay, so you know, I try and be a bit cautious in my phrasing because, you know, I've been thinking about this stuff for years. So what we're seeing is we're seeing a transformation in what I call our people operating system, right? And we're seeing megacorps, right? And they're substituting the Constitution for terms of service, and they're substituting territorial sovereignty, right, for functional sovereignty. And there's a lot of proof of this. And, you know, I've been talking about this for years. In this entire COVID period, you know, even before that, I've called it the fastest roll up of power in history. Study very academically, and I'll just call it the period of Alexander the Great, if you want, because I don't want to get too bogged down in it, to, the middle years of the Roman Empire. And you weren't looking at that many years, right? In reality, you're really looking at from let's say from the fall of Alexander to the split up into the empire to Augustus, just a very short amount of time. And now you're seeing that compressed into really what's amounted to 7 or 8 years, and you've really seen the pedal on the accelerator over the last 4 years, where the political apparatus, AOC, she's an idiot. She's not going anywhere. It's over because the megacorps are using those kids as their phalanx, and so some part of them, they're using their own prop. They're using their own marketing for not only their external clients but their internal clients, which is their employees. And basically, the conditional agreement is that we'll keep you as a W-2 if you go out there and help us and help install us. People are finding, and I've been talking about this for years, that and I've given to a lot of politicians. I mean, it's public record. I don't care. All Democrats, and I've raised a bundle. So people are finding that the politicians, I can give anybody a call, even with me now, they're going to take, a day or two to get back to me. And I can call anybody. I've got everybody's cell phone. And because then they'll look me up and say what we've given, blah, blah, blah. Or I'll just, go in through this person or that person. But nevertheless, not only that, but they're different. They're now too rich. In Roman times, I would say that they've all retired to Ravenna. And they've left the gates to Rome wide open. They don't care. And in that vacuum, the megacorps have filled that vacuum. And this has been deliberate. Politicians didn't want to get elected, didn't care about getting elected anymore. Nothing. There's no threat to Nancy Pelosi or Mitch or any of these. Well, Mitch is a little bit vulnerable, but to the real power elite. And at the same time, they've used Antifa very cleverly, and they've used these social movements very cleverly. Because that's the mechanism that they've used to extricate the DC elite and the power structure. And you have to, in order for this to work for them, they've got to tear down all the statues. This is I'm very familiar with China, and I have big positions bearish on China. But within that language, within that conceptual framework, you would say that it's the four alls, which is when they instructed the Red Guard and a whole bunch of the apparatus there to take out all the rituals and everything. So they tore up even graveyards, and they did some hideous things. And but in order for these megacorps to take over, they need to erase what was before, because if there's any remnant and even recollection in people's minds of what was before, then they'll strive to return to that. So when people get out of their houses from COVID, the world has changed, right? And people won't remember the way it was before. And I was way against any of this stuff. They never, there was, I was way against the COVID nonsense from the very beginning. That's not to say that the virus was not real and that it wouldn't have real morbidity associated with it, and that there were some other things. They never presented any type of an economic argument commensurate with the shutdown, right?
Well,
Did you ever see?
going back to what you said, it's not about being right or wrong. It's about appropriately managing risk. And managing risk means managing across the spectrum, not just COVID, other health issues, social issues, economic issues, and the like. And they took a very, very narrow view of what they were going to do to try to be,
How do you
quote
know it's a
unquote,
narrow
right.
view? How do you know it's a narrow view? You were
Well,
part of that negotiation.
say that again?
How do you know what the view that they took was never articulated?
Well,
So a narrow view.
you could see by what they did. It was impossible for them to take any other view based on their outcome, unless, again, it was intentional, which I would argue is that a narrow view as
It
well.
was intentional.
That is a narrow view.
Okay, but your the way you had presented it was that there were choices being offered, and they chose one over the other. And I'm telling you that there was never choices being offered. I can tell you, I mean, I keep a COVID log. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that, but I started keeping a log in January, And again, I'm kind of there's certain things I'm a specialist of in China. And I knew when I saw those videos of people kind of spontaneously combusting in China, and those videos were making it to Twitter, that I suspected that that was not the case. And you know, it still hasn't been confirmed. But you know, when these videos leak out, China exercises what's called discourse power, and I didn't think if China didn't want them to make it onto Twitter, I was pretty certain that they wouldn't have made it onto Twitter, or they would have been seized immediately. So I knew that there was a lot of dissent going on in the mainland. I knew there was a lot of social and economic turmoil going on in the mainland. The ones you saw was in Hong Kong, and that's just because where all the media outlets in the West have stations. They don't have stations on the mainland. So I was familiar with the collapse of the Belt and Road, and I was expecting them to do a propaganda warfare because I knew things were deteriorating for them very quickly. So I saw all the ultra-violence. I saw the triad gangs being used by the People's Armed Police. So, you know, I saw what was going on, and then I knew that it was going to kind of metastasize into America because I saw, you know, you may not remember it, but in Europe, there have been protests for the last 2 years. About a whole bunch of different issues, largely about carbon taxes and green taxes, you know, the extraordinary costs
Sure,
that are
sure.
now being imposed. In Greece, there was, you know, about immigration, because, and that's a real serious issue over there because it was displacing the indigenous people over there, and creating enormous inflation. There was a whole bunch of protests. There was the insurgents that labeled them. They were labeled were given a umbrella called the Yellow Vest, right? So I saw that, you know, the Trump election was a wage earner revolt, and our elites were terrified of that European descent moving over here, right? Because these things move. Remember, you know, we're done with territorial sovereignty. It's all functional now. So those social movements move really quickly. They were terrified of it coming over here. So it suited a lot of things. And I keep a log, and it's meticulous. And it's not just about COVID, where I don't have any opinions about mask or HCQ or any of that. I have no opinions about anything with that stuff. All I'm trying to do is to chronicle the fastest roll-up of power in history. And so when you said, you know, it was a narrow type of thing, my passionate response is that, you know, insurance only, you know, you can't insure everything, right? You have to, and I've been in the insurance and the actuarial business. So if you know, you can't insure everything. So you've got to present risks that are commensurate with you know, with cost, right? And that was never done. So then you take a look at things like New York, where Mayor de Blasio and, you know, Governor Cuomo basically acted as an accelerant, and it caused a lot of cryptic transmission. And that's well documented. So you know, the mega corps are taking over, and I think that they no longer have to conceal themselves, right? Because take a look at now, people are celebrating that Michael Bloomberg is spending $100+ million in Florida, and people are celebrating it, and it's a I don't know how people can applaud that.
Well, it drives me crazy because it's the same people who, you know, went during the primary debates and said billionaires and their wine caves shouldn't be picking who's president until it works for me, and then I'm okay with it. And that kind of hypocrisy drives me crazy.
So what we're seeing then is we're seeing kind of a, we're seeing a, and I just had a conversation with Paul Gottfried, who's extremely conservative, but he is a, he wrote a book called After Liberalism, and I really wanted to talk with him, so we did on YouTube, just because I really wanted to fight with him on thing, because he's so brilliant. And he's an authority. His background is German and post-German, German post-Enlightenment philosophy, which is just a remarkable thing. And so he has a real kind of framework to deal with all this, philosophical framework, economic. I mean, it was a remarkable time. So we're really seeing kind of a return to city charters. The oligarchs are going to carve up America. They're doing it right now. You know, Eric Schmidt, now Google Eric Schmidt, are going to be responsible for our education curriculum in New York. It'll be done and presented differently, but it is. So they are effectively dividing up the spoils. So my question is not, is America going to be a worse place or a better place, right? It's going to be a different place. My wish is that they would be a bit more honest, because the mega corps and the elites like Mike Bloomberg no longer feel they have to hide it, right? They're being celebrated by the phalanx. They're being celebrated by the left as a hero. Mike Bloomberg is becoming a very dangerous person, and in a functioning democracy, he would be being interrogated, right? So the megacorps are taking over. So part of this is also my investment thesis, right? If the world is being defragmented, right, then and the world is being cartelized, and America is being cartelized, you've got to buy the cartels. Because people say, well, Tesla, this and this and this, they don't know what they're talking about. Reality is the auto companies in America cannot survive. Obama proved that with his disastrous UAW bailout, okay? And he went out saying that we're not going to endorse all these private equity shops because they're all kind of larcenous and blah, blah, blah. And I'm not against or pro-Obama. I'm just talking about those certain circumstances that, if you recall the fiat and Chrysler swap that he did, the share swap that he did. And the spigot was open then. The spigot was opened up before that with the auto bailouts, and the spigot was opened up with a whole bunch of things. And then with the Obamacare, where we saw a kind of HHS being pilfered, and now we're going to continue to see that. So we're seeing the megacorps really take over. So my question then is, how do we get our kids to be able to survive in that environment, right? Because we all want them to flourish. I don't think America necessarily becomes a horrible place, right? Even Biden wins, I'm fine with that. World is fine. We all live on. How are our kids going to profit? They're going to profit because they've got to have more of a hustle. They've got to work. There's a lot of competition out there. And the reality is that they're now going to be working for the country of Amazon. They're now going to be working for the country of Google. And when you work in that environment, because I've been the head of that environment, I've been one of the largest shareholders in so many different companies, or, our fund manager has, and we segregate funds. So you've got to be a good citizen, right? Good citizens don't protest. They don't cause trouble. They're very respectful. They can operate in a rigid hierarchical system. So, and they have to be articulate, because if you're dealing with a Jeff Bezos or something that's on his periphery, right? These are going to be very articulate, very well-spoken. They're going to have complex system views. And kids today don't have that complex system view. They have what you said is a very, what you said in a different context is a very narrow view. They don't understand systems whatsoever. They think they do, but they don't understand systems. They've never walked in every single department of a big company and spent days picking their brain so they can understand how these things as a living organism work.
Well, not only that, they've outsourced everything to technology. So they've taken everything, every return they've gotten as given. They've never had to do the work to get them up to that point in time.
They're not going to function in this new world. They're not going to make it. They don't have the emotional reservoir. They're too busy protesting. And I've been saying this from the day they started protesting. I timestamp all these on Twitter. I said, these people are going to be NAFTA'd. They're going to be exhausted, because you and I remember the 2001 protest. It had a lot of authenticity and genuineness to them, right? But these things looked like that protest, but they weren't. So what was happening is they were doing the Me Too was the first one, right? All those ridiculous pink hats. They've been continuously emotionally drained. And it's mostly these young kids that work for Facebook, they work for Google, or their parents are on pension. They've been completely emotionally depleted and completely emotionally drained, and they could not fight back to defend their own jobs. And I call it they're being NAFTA'd, except at least the auto workers put up a fight. These kids aren't even putting up a fight. And now that they're getting fired, I've just been buying the stock. I'm like, all right, I do not mourn their loss. I don't mourn the loss of our Constitution. I just wish that there was more debate about it. And I wish there was a more sincerity to it. And instead, we're just seeing all these social issues, and we're seeing kind of social equality has been, economic equality has been substituted for social equality, right? And I want economic equality. That's what we were discussing, give everybody a couple hundred shares of stock. But these people are not being given it. They're being given this type of social equality that you can't cash that check at the bank.
No, I mean, this is mind blowing. And it's somewhat depressing for me because I do mourn the loss of the Constitution. I'm a free marketeer, so this is sort of blowing my mind here. Normally at this point in time, we would do a Now You Know segment where you're going to tell us one more thing, but because this has been such an interesting conversation, a different conversation, you get to wrap it with whatever you want. So okay. Yes, now you can say what you wanted to say.
So, you know, I've been pretty outspoken. You know, I have a position in a few different companies, and I'll include Tesla and I'll include Boeing. I'm not worried about the loss of capitalism at all. America is a capitalist country. There's nothing they're going to be able to do to surgically remove that. It's just not going to happen, or at least it'll take a long time. But so what I do worry about is the things that I'm the most excited about, like Space Force, right? It's going to create millions and millions, tens of millions of jobs. We're going to have a cislunar orbit, people living on the moon, a whole bunch of different things. It's going to change energy. It's going to be beamed down from space, blah, blah, blah. And it's going to create a lot of startups. The thing that I worry about is I'm watching it already becoming privatized, where that used to be a public asset, right? But now America can no longer afford to invest the money in both, because complexity is expensive, and solving those high-hanging fruit problems that are needed for a space force are innovation of that type, high-hanging fruit, large team innovation, is extremely expensive. So the federal government can't afford that because they're promising college to all these idiots and a Green New Deal, blah, blah, blah. You know, all these rhetorical devices that are going to deplete their funds. And instead, companies like Amazon, Tesla, SpaceX, blah, 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 you name it, Lockheed, they're going to privatize all of this. And so I don't like watching what I'm watching now, which is us giving away those national assets, because they really are. Just because it's not the Statue of Liberty in the middle of a harbor with a torch, it's just as much of a national asset. Boeing, Tesla, you ask anybody in any country. I go to China, not allowed in China anymore because I have a bearish position, but I know a lot of people there. And you ask them about Elon Musk. You ask them about Space Force. They love it. They know our companies. So I'm sad to see SpaceX and all these companies acquiring America's national assets and acquiring them at a substantial discount. That's my closing note. What do you think?
It's fascinating, and it's interesting because I have I separate privatization from capitalism, and I'm very much into individual rights and free markets. So to me, it really is the selling out we've been talking about here, the selling out of Main Street to Wall Street, and mm-hmm. from the little guy to the big guy, mm-hmm. and that's that's sad in the realm of individual rights and free markets and capitalism. But it's been an amazing, fascinating discussion, Adam. We didn't even get to like a quarter of the topics I wanted to talk to you about, so we'll definitely have to do it again. But thank you so much for making the time.
And thank you so much for hosting me and allowing me this conversation. And I hope I was a good guest.
You are amazing. Where can people, it sounds like Twitter is the place where you timestamp everything. Just tell everybody where they can connect with you.
Yeah, so I don't have any books. You know, I've got a family also. I just focus on my own life and my own happiness. I use Twitter as a timestamp, and I also used to write a lot of threads on Twitter. I'm not sure if you've ever seen those. They're awesome. And I write about China. I write about taxes, because those are my own internal notes that we have within our family office. But I try and distill them. I feel like it's a public service, like it's news that I'm sharing because it's something you're not getting from other places. And I do it in a very entertaining way. So I guess if you want to find me, I'm on LinkedIn somewhere. I don't check it too often.
And your Twitter handle?
My Twitter handle is Adam Scrabble. And I guess you can put that up there. But Scrabble is one of my favorite games. It's my hobby. And I think about the forensics and the postmortems of Scrabble. And it's also part of family also have. So Adam Scrabble.
That's Adam's Scrabble, which by the way is much it flows off the tongue much more nicely than Adam's earnings call, which is your other hobby, right?
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks again to Adam Townsend. That does it for this episode of The Roth Effect. I would love to hear from you, so feel free to leave a comment at Ricochet. Tweet to me like you tweet to Adam, but I'm at Carol J.S. Roth on Twitter. Subscribe, Ricochet, iTunes, wherever fine podcasts are downloaded, so you never miss an episode of The Roth Effect.
Ricochet. Join the conversation.